We're back. It's season 8 million. I hope you missed us. Poetic peeps and gentle persons, in-betweeners and non-conformers, genders all and genders equal, welcome to Eat the Storms, a poetry podcast. This is episode 1 of season 8, not 8 million. I am Damien B. Donnelly, your host and producer, and thank you so much for joining us today. Whether that's been on Spotify, Apple, Google, Breaker, Podbean, Player FM, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Castbox, Podcast Addicts, or iTunes. As usual, we have four guests joining me on the show today to share their voices, to treat you, to take you on trips, to trip you out, or maybe just to open your mind to new ways of thinking or listening. And one of those guests will join me at the end for Behind the Storms, our new interview series examining the how, the why, and the what of poetry. How we got into it, why it captured us, and what we have done with it since. On today's episode, we are hearing from debut poetry pamphlets alongside T.S. Eliot Prize shortlisted collections. We have guests from Chile, from the United States, from Ireland and the United Kingdom. We are talking about love, love of the land, the loss of the land, how we deal with being parents, how we understand autism. So for the next 70 minutes, I suggest you find yourself a comfortable place to relax. Ensure that you have food to nibble on and something seductive to drink. My name is Damien B. Donnelly. This is Eat the Storms, a poetry podcast, and I hope you enjoy the show. And so my first guest for season 8, episode 1, is an Irishman who comes from County Cork, although he splits his time between Ireland and Chile. He is a poet, writer and translator, and this is the second time he's appeared on the podcast, and I'm delighted to say that he will be joining me again at the end of today's episode, as he is my first guest on the Behind the Storms interview series. His debut pamphlet was called Islands of Chile, published in 2022 by 14 Poems, and he followed that in November of 2023 with No Man's Land, his debut full collection published by Daedalus Press. A columnist for Harper Bazaar Korea and Elle Korea, he's also a children's author of books in Spanish. I'm delighted to hand you over to David Nash.
Hi there, Dave. My name is David Nash. I'm very happy to be invited back to read for Eat the Storms. So first off, I have to thank Damien for having me, and for whoever is listening for listening. I'm going to read from my first full collection of poetry, No Man's Land, which came out in November with Daedalus Press. Just as a little bit of background, the book came out of my moving back to Ireland and my home in rural West Cork a few years ago, after a long time away, and rediscovering the landscape and riverscape of my upbringing, and finding there was so much I didn't know, from folklore to land knowledge to Irish, the Irish language itself. And inevitably, I suppose, given the state of the environment, it became a book about loss and personal loss as a reflection of that. The first poem I'm going to read is called Elegy for an Eel in Advance. Elegy, because in this moment you have no inkling that you'll die, but you will die. Advance, since forward and forward are homophones in some dialects. Eel, according to the Oxford Dictionary of Etymology, comes from Proto-Germanic elas, which is of unknown origin. For, an, in, and a comma, because these, like some other squiggles I know, might seem immaterial in the grand scheme of things, but aren't. All coincidence begins and ends in the Lee being my nearest river, your mirror. But language isn't astrology, nor neatness kismet. You aren't bound for me. You're somewhere off Bermuda. You're an eyelash in the Gulf Stream, too far down even for torchlight. And what? Are you really so slick as to thread every eye and sneak past every trawler in the Atlantic? To get to where I am, behind a dam which is itself behind another dam, in circumferences of chance I give you a snowball's. Plus, you'd have to really want to, and I doubt you do. I understand that there is no such thing as a river too good to pass up. Rusalka, Selki, Sedna, Varun, Clownlir, Becca Hesten, Mulguishin, Bunyip, Leviathan, Siren, Pinkoya, Poseidon, Noah, Styx. Whose ever mythology got water right, I wish you theirs. I spend a lot of time during my year in Chile, and I'm working on a book of translations of poets who are working in the indigenous Mapudungun language of southern Chile. And I found that, of course, while I was kind of scouting for participants for the kind of anthology, that an awful lot of their work has to do with nature loss too. What I'm going to read is not a translation, but it's a poem after a poem that I read in the process of my research by a poet called Lionel Lienlaf. Ill Wind. Across the stump fields, desperate, panting, the wind turns back on itself, a Labrador duped by the dummy throw. It unhinges then, can't fathom there's a world unholdable in its teeth, a bird's nest it can't bracket. A few summers ago, I guess, or last summer, a few summers ago, I was in the Burn doing a residency, and I came across the idea or the fact of turlochs for the first time. These are, if you don't know, lakes that appear and disappear depending on the level of the water table or however much it's rained. And one day this discovery, this fact, impeded my walk home. Turlock. Water with its moon in Libra. Now you see it. Sudden water. Where yesterday you'd happened on a desire path home, which would have halved the time it takes. Now with water, doubled. Doubled water. The lake you see before you now is the lake you don't, inverted. The water table with its legs in the air, an underground, overed, a frown upside downed. You roll your jeans up to ford or afford it, and exactly at waist height you are one of two things, an anchor tethering sky or the lake's space program. This water one day will leave land in its wake. You will stand in a grass meniscus while the water untroubled summers in closure. Now you don't. I realised while writing the book that a lot of the landmarks that seemed so mighty in memory were quite modest in reality upon rediscovery. And I thought about how that's how that's often the case with firsts, your first river, your first mountain, your first love, even. I spent every summer of my childhood in the shadow of Sleeve Moore in Achill Island, which seemed at the time insuperable, but I went back for the first time in about 20 years to see that it's a pretty humble thing, really. This poem is divided in three. The first third, I suppose, is Sleeve Moore, the anglicisation of the name of the mountain. The second is On Sleeve of Moor, which is the Irish of it. And the third is The Big Mountain, which is the literal translation. Sleeve Moore. Not just any mountain. In metres all told, not even that. Sleeve Moore is cetacean in memory. It never soared. It surfaced. Every summer, some mainlander would mistake weather for climate and scale it in a dry spell, unready for the heavy hand of mist that inevitably fell and swept them off it like whatever was left of the bread from the breakfast table. On Sleeve Moor. I've ridden others. I'm not talking mountain range numbers of mountains, but mountains enough for comparison. Mountains with main character strut. Background mountains, greener mountains, browner. I've broken some mountains in, been broken back in by some mountains. I have palmed escarpments to tameness. I've drawn ridges up into themselves, given form sometimes to arêtes with just one look. I've clung to mountains that gave no purchase to the spur. Dumb mountains, mountains covered in dust, mountains that buck on fault lines, and mountains, in the end, that were not worth mustering. The worst thing is to find that the first one, all this time, was enough. The Big Mountain. A field of bog cotton at the big mountain's foot nods in deference, in surrender, and in unison. A scattering of Catholics at sea. Not just any mountain. The. The last poem I'm going to read is called Cuina. The whole book, I suppose, is a kind of Cuina. But this poem is a cuina for the cuina itself, in a way, a tradition, a cuina for a tradition that has faded into memory, if even that. Cuina. I'll whisht soon, I promise, but first a little grief. Different, though, from the species of keening we know, for if I were to keen in print, I would rightly be cancelled. A posteriori. By dint of being dead, or at least old, its will takes precedence over mine to resurrect it. So how do you lament then? To whom? For whose benefit? Soon I'll whisht, I promise. Soon. Thank you very much for listening. Gurmagif.
My next guest today is from the United Kingdom and will be reading from her prize-winning pamphlet Magpie's Nest, which won the Frosted Fire First Pamphlet Award last year. And as she'll tell you herself, it stemmed from her son being diagnosed with autism during lockdown. She's had work in places like Sentinel Literary Quarterly, Porridge, Obsessed with Pipework and The Interpreter's House. Her poem, Autistic Weather, from Magpie's Nest, won the Brian Dempsey Memorial Prize in 2023. With a love of writing about our connection to nature and how neurodiversity can give different perspectives on the world, I'm very pleased to welcome to Eat the Storms for the first time, Claire Starling.
Thank you, Damien. I'm going to read some poems from my pamphlet, Magpie's Nest. I wrote these poems at a time when my 10-year-old son was diagnosed with autism, and they are about the joys and challenges of living with autism in the family. Autistic weather. A storm bursts in. It rolls you on the sofa. Spraying rain, your hair thrashed into tangles. You shudder under terrors of endless sleet. I coax you with cold chicken like a half-drowned feral cat. Once on dry ground, you sniff at a boiled egg, accept a packet of Wotsits and a passion fruit. Warm and fed, you start singing something cloudless of your own creation. Your weather is devastating. All I can do is forecast, put up storm boards for you, sweep up your broken glass. Haircut. Your hair is a wild mushroom. No, a squirrel's nest. The colour of Heinz tomato, the colour of orange leaves. You look like a child in oils, lavishly ringleted, who has travelled in time through a hedge and glares out weird as the world. Your fork in the socket frizz attracts praise in the temperate house, but at school, rules are rules, and you're an explosive reaction of copper. Tie it back or cut it is a declaration of violence. Your personal Bastille, you bitterly reject the guillotine. You're incorruptible, while I whisper on about self-care, gagging my fear-filled fury, lest I come at you at night with blades. Instead, I pressure you with my soft tectonic weight until you give me 30 seconds with the scissors. No time for neatening up, so you remain shock-headed. And who says you should not be let out like that? They should see your sapphire eyes, the worlds that curl out from you, sitting between my legs, warm in pyjamas, birthing new planets, monsters and gods, while I comb spray through your snarls, trying not to hurt you. Pathological demand avoidance. The labels written on your soft hand in smudgy biro, you tell me, this is what I have. Tally's story read out to your class, revealed what slams down when you won't tie your laces, watch the explainer on fractions, tolerate the prickly judo master, practice any single thing over again. You wrung like a bath towel in your red plastic seat, hands over your ears, reached for recognition like a rubber ring when you're swept off your feet in the deep end, the wave machine on full tilt. Ribbon. When you cry, I gather it in like a wide red ribbon. It keeps coming, like when you press print on a 1,000-page document. If I put out a hand, you'll take it. Let me lead you up the stairs, the ribbon looping out between the banister spindles. I gather it in my arms as you battle against each item of uniform. The ribbon spurts out between bursts of the electric toothbrush. It fills the car as I drive. It spills out, shiny as blood, when you open the door. It gushes, then at last it stops. You cross the road into school. You give me a little wave. And I think, what am I going to do with all this ribbon? Pokemon in the cemetery. At the grave of Blondine Tightrope Walker, you got two great balls and a pineapple berry. At the mausoleum of James Morrison, you battled with a Growlithe. You beat it easily with your sand slash. At the Sawyer Tomb, grade 2 listed by English Heritage, you evolved your Woobat into a Swoobat. Walking west, the canal was there beyond the railings, and woodland sheltered older graves. A woman passed us with wrapped flowers. I did not raise my head in time to meet her eyes with an apology. Me and you spending this morning, smelling the turning leaves, feeling the misty rain, wiping it away from the bright screen. The claw grip. You add cooking to our poster titled, How Can I Feel Calm? It's a new one on me. You've no truck for recipes, squishy textures, mixtures, melanges, or offers of help. Prickly as a Michelin-starred diva, you chop an onion, keen to demonstrate the claw grip you learned in food tech, knuckles white as that damp orb, cutting awkwardly into crisp, pale flesh. With a grip like that, how can you fail to succeed? High pitch. Red moon over your lip, the awkward grip, the stumbling slide, your furious mop head extruded in the stretched metal of the bell. Like jammed clockwork, arms not long enough for the trombone, you're enraged that it won't work, like everything. But in a blink, you see you're playing piccolo high. You hoot it out low, you ring the change. Each note sounds out, deep and good, and after all, it was easy. And this is my final poem, The Bee Saver. You always spot tired bees, and then we can't move on until I've got out my card holder. They clamber on, waving their feelers. We scout for flowers between brick walls and spiny city planting. Into this untended patch of mallow and borage crawls the bee. Early spring, you saw one on the way to school. I could not rush you past. I offered it my card. It roused itself, climbed on and rode with me. I made up sugar water, tipped the damp bee until it rested one weightless leg upon my finger, leaned in, unrolled its tongue, drank its minuscule fill. I left it in a patch of sun. In an hour, the bee had gone, perhaps a queen waking from her winter sleep to begin a new nest. You were so proud of me. You called me the bee saver. I think it was the honour of my life.
My next guest, we are travelling to the United States, this time for another returning guest, Stormer to Eat the Storms, the founder of Poetry X Hunger, which aims to bring the community of poets to the anti-hunger cause. His work has appeared in many journals and anthologies, and his most recent collection, Patchy Ways, was published in 2023 by Cyberwit Press. After being inundated with praise for his last appearance on Eat the Storms, I'm so pleased to welcome back, reading from his upcoming collection, Hiram LaRue.
I'm Hiram LaRue from the East Coast of the U.S. It's my pleasure to rejoin Eat the Storms, and I'm very grateful to Damien for his magic in creating and producing the program. Most of the poems that follow are from an upcoming collection tentatively titled This Much Very. The first poem is about looking back in awe through memory and forgetfulness. It first appeared in Flat Ink magazine. It's titled Smoky Arms. Lately, I've been amazed by my father's memory as I remember him. He could recall as brightly as the skins of apples how his father was certain but quiet. My father also knew by heart what the snow looked like on those very steps where he first spied my mother. And he had an uncanny way as well of remembering where the smallest creeks cross in West Virginia. More and more, my father seems to me to be sitting on the edge of a bed in boxers, or is stoking a nearby fire, telling stories. More and more, I think of him as very sure, like me, of people, even before he's ever met them. And of course, he was squirrely-eyed about anyone in power. In fact, more and more as I think back, it's almost as if my father has been lifted up in the chilly air by some smoky arms as a favor. That's all to say that there's nothing he wouldn't have done for bright, foggy mornings like this, ones that start heading out, but then have to turn around on a damn dime to go all the way back home for whatever it was that was forgotten. The next poem is all about someone wondering what it would be like to look like a movie star. It first appeared in San Antonio Review. It's titled Hollywood. For sure, I'd pull out my last tooth to be that tall, dark, and handsome. And yes, maybe be willing to die real young, just so I could live on in posters. But before that, I'd like to have the kind of looks that stop nearly anything breathing in its tracks as it stares at me and my marvel, at my boatload of handy dandy and my cup running over, if you get my drift. I'd give my good eye to be an eyeful of a best-looking swoon angel, the kind of, oh my goodness, that's like when butter meets honey, for sure. Yes, my magazine looks should be the best ever seen since hair was parted by Moses or someone Egyptian. I'd even give a twist on this bad thumb to be irresistible. And yes, that's spelled like a parade float with a real sexy eye waving up front and a big bad E grinning in the rear, if you get my drift. Truly, I'd give up my last smoke, the very best one, I'm told, to have those kind of God-idol looks, so that whenever, however, and as ever I went, each heavenly bolt and blast of light would itself trip and fall in mud, gawking up at me. This last poem is a wistful look back and ahead. It appeared in my last collection, Patchy Ways. It's titled Wishes Find. A place that barely goes to is how I've come along. Those greetings gold with shyly are where my wishes find. And ways of curling whispers or trails that disappear are how my life keeps guessing or roves through love with ifs of going on. Thanks very, very much.
We are coming back to Ireland now for the recent T.S. Eliot Prize shortlisted poet, who was also shortlisted for the Forward Prize for her collection A Change in the Air, which was published in 2023 by Blood Axe Books. She grew up in County Roscommon here in Ireland, but currently lives in Glenmalure in County Wicklow with her wife, where she combines writing her own work, being a creative writing tutor and a group facilitator. In 2016, she won the Hennessy Literary Award for Emerging Poetry and was the inaugural winner of the Listowel Writers Week Poem of the Year. Her second collection, When the Tree Falls, was shortlisted in 2020 for the Piggott Poetry Prize, and last year she collaborated with visual artist Jane Clarkhill on the illustrated anthology Windfall, Irish Nature Poems to Inspire and Connect. Joining us today to read from that recent third collection, A Change in the Air, it's an honour to welcome Jane Clark.
Hello, my name's Jane Clark, and I'm delighted to read you a few poems from my most recent collection, A Change in the Air. It was published in May 2023 by Blood Axe Books. So the collection is in six sequences, and the theme of change flows through each of them, starting with my mother's memory loss, moving to poems about the mining heritage in Three Valleys in County Wicklow, poems inspired by letters from a soldier in the First World War, poems about the impact of the partition of Ireland. And then there are poems about loss and restoration in our environment. And there are love poems, poems reflecting on social and political change. And even there are a few poems about the experience of the pandemic in the Wicklow Uplands. So I'll start with a poem that I wrote in October 2022. Dressing my mother for her grandson's wedding. A darker shade of blue than her eyes. The dress has slept for years in the wardrobe, next to the clothes she won't let me give away. She raises her arms for me, though she's forgotten why she can't stay by the fire with her collie. A new pair of tights, an old pair of shoes softened at the toes and heels. She winces at the touch of her hairbrush. No sign of her pearls. I dredge through photos and medicines on top of the chest of drawers, find them coiled around her engagement ring. She chooses a scarf, red as her lipstick. I tell her there's a beautiful woman in the mirror. She laughs. I might find a new man at the wedding. And then in a whisper, sorry, Charlie, as if he's with us in their bedroom, listening. So the next poem, I was inspired by a conversation with a miner in Glendassen Mine in County Wicklow, where he had worked with the pit ponies. Now he finished work back in 1957 when that mine, the last mine in Wicklow, was closed. But he remembered vividly details of their work with the ponies. Pit ponies of Glendassen. Hitched to an 8-hour shift in britchens, hames and traces, they follow the miners' carbide lights, halt under hoppers, turn on a threepence and lean into their collars to pull the 5-wagon train. Low-set cobs from the curragh, a piebald and 2 greys, Their hooves fall heavy as hammers on granite. They haul lengths of larch for pit props, pneumatic drills, boxes of gelignite, and from time to time deliver injured men back to daylight. The miners pat their necks in passing, feed them windfall apples. Comrades in toil, and first to stall, legs locked at a sudden rumbling, a change in the air, or the rush of running water. The next poem I'd like to read you is really a tribute to my parents, and it's a poem about mutual acceptance and change and love. Spalls. To help us grow a garden, my mother and father travelled across the Bog of Allen and over the Wicklow Gap. They'd have preferred to drive west to Galway or Mayo. They'd have preferred a husband and children, but their daughter loved a woman. We'd have the table set for breakfast, rashers, black pudding, fried bread and eggs. When the soil had warmed, we unloaded shovels and rakes, buckets of compost and the rusted iron bar for prizing out rocks. The back seat was thronged with pots of seedlings my mother had nurtured all winter. We worked to her bidding, loosened tangled roots before planting, sow marigolds next to beans, sprinkle Epsom salts around roses. My father took off on his own to spud ragwort or clip a hedge. One day, he spent hours gathering stones of different shapes and sizes. By evening, he'd built us a wall under the holly, held together by gravity and friction, hearted with handfuls of spalls. So a poem from lockdown. When a neighbour of ours died, he was in his 80s, and we couldn't have the usual funeral, so we stood out on either side of the road the morning his hearse was brought to, the hearse travelled to the church in Ballinatone. Shepherd. When he was a boy, these upland fields grew more gorse and rushes than grass. He dug up rocks, shifted stones to ditches and laneways, ploughed hummocks into the ground, harrowed furrows, seeded tilt. We'd meet him on our way up Kirrikee. Crouched to a ewe on our rump, he'd be clearing thorns from sore hooves before trimming. He'd pause to lament harsh weather or laugh at lambs nudging each other from hillocks. Was it last year we first saw him sit for a breath, his collie resting her head on his knee? On a midwinter morning, neighbours lined the length of road downhill to the church at Ballinatone. Ewes huddled close in lambing sheds, and through the five-bar gate to the yard, an easterly wind rings silver. And so my final poem is a love poem. And yeah, it's set in our garden in Glenmalure, June. Because wild rose fills the garden to the sultry scented brim, and hawk moths flock to fuchsia, humming a wordless hymn. Because pipistrels flicker past heartbeats on the wing, and tonight's the eve of your birthday, the air warm as your skin. Because it's bright till almost midnight, and the days will be short too soon. Let's stay out here and listen for the wood pigeon's five-note tune. So thank you very much for your listening, and thank you, Damien, for inviting me to contribute to the podcast. Goodbye.
And just like that, it's time for a chat. This is the first of this season's Behind the Storms interviews. And each week I will chat to one poet about beginnings, about the how and the why poetry captured their attention, and discuss a little bit more about their processes and their collections. David, thank you so much for joining me today. This is the first Eat the Storms mini interview. When I started, I originally thought all of these episodes are going to be pre-recorded. It will be just each guest sending me in the audio because they're all living in too many different countries and I'd never be able to keep in contact with all of those time zones. But it's season 8. Therefore, season 8 comes with the pressure of having to grow. And so I've decided that I'm going to interview at least one of the guests. And so thank you so much for joining us all the way from Chile, even though you are from Ireland. How long have you been there? What are you doing in Chile?
Thanks for having me, first of all. How long have I been here? I came here first about 7 years ago. And I come and go. So I'm not here the whole year round. It's about 6 months on, 6 months off, depending on the year. Sometimes I'm not here very often. Like last year, I wasn't here very often at all. Mm-hmm. And I won't be here for much longer either. I kind of moved here on a whim. I had been living in London for quite a long time and I was really sick of it and got offered a job here and came and then quit the job, but stayed in the country.
And had you been to Chile before that at all?
No, I didn't really know anything about it either. I didn't speak Spanish at the time. It sort of fell in with a group of artists and have ended up working with them and with people they knew and with people they knew. And I can survive off that here. I could never survive off that in Ireland. So,
But you've maintained that sense of connection with Ireland. You still come back. It's not that you've left.
No, and in a way, I don't feel like I live here. When people say, like, where do you live? I kind of hesitate because I live in Ireland and I also live here. I suppose in the past sort of three, four years, the connection with Ireland has been a lot stronger as well. Pandemic kind of was a catalyst to that. Yeah. Because I found myself in Ireland and I couldn't leave, even if I had wanted to. And that fed into the book. That sort of connection with Ireland in many ways kind of got a lot more profound the last like 3 or 4 years. So I feel not more Irish or anything like that, but I've sort of made an effort to connect with what that might mean.
And clearly, and congratulations, you mentioned the book there. So huge congratulations on No Man's Land, which came out in November last year, wasn't it, with Daedalus Press?
In November.
I grabbed my copy at Books Upstairs yesterday, and I have literally already been earmarking my favourite poems. Half of the book is already earmarked just since yesterday. So huge congratulations. It follows on from Islands of Chile, from 14 poems, and then prior to that, you had your children's Spanish book. But perhaps before we get into No Man's Land, the idea of doing these interviews is to go back kind of to the beginning and to talk about poets, to talk about what inspired them first of all. So you're now in Chile, you grew up in Ireland, down in Cork, but then I was wondering, I suppose, where along the road of growing up, where did this interest in poetry spring from? You can tell already from the collection that it definitely came from the landscape, but how did it first grab you?
I was having this exact conversation yesterday, actually, and I seem to remember always writing. There was something about the achievement of shaping a sentence well, be that in a joke or a turn of phrase that resonated or that landed well from really early. I found that there was a kind of a pleasure in doing that. I wrote stuff down as a kid constantly, but I suppose I didn't really know that what I was doing was poetry until much later.
Were there influences from the family in terms of writing or expression or performance?
Not in an explicit way, but my family have creative minds, definitely.
Yeah.
And that sort of idea of being able to shape a sentence well definitely was an important thing growing up, you know, like having the mots justes, something that has value in our family. And that definitely had an influence, and it definitely encouraged everyone in the family to kind of up their game constantly, you know.
And did poetry then become, even though perhaps you hadn't named it as poetry, but the writing was that sort of cathartic in a way of sort of figuring out who you were, your position, your place?
No, and I don't look at poetry as being a catharsis either. If anything, it's an escape from emotion for me. There's a lot of people who are able to transfer or to work through their experience as it happens, you know, contemporaneously. But I find that I need an awful lot of distance from the feeling in order to write the feeling, you know. And it's never been any different for me. I have never looked at it as a way of like, oh, I need to write something down right now to work out what's going on in my head or in my heart. No.
Do you think then distance to a degree helped in the formation perhaps of No Man's Land?
In the sense of distance from feeling, yeah. Physical distance, no, because the book itself has to do with my immediate surroundings in rural West Cork. It was sort of a reaction to what was physically in front of me, but a lot of the sort of emotion that goes into those poems and my inner life, almost all of those poems were written at a remove of 6-7 months.
And do you remember when you first called yourself a poet, called yourself a writer? Do you remember the first sort of time sharing? Was that embarrassing, exciting when other people read your work?
I worked, like I kept working at poetry, and it's a craft, you know, like you get better the more you do it. And I remember going up to my parents' attic at some point when I was about 20 or 21, and I wrote something and I thought, that's a poem, you know. I've been writing poems in inverted commas for an awful long time, and I wrote this thing down and I thought, like, oh shit, I think I've actually done the thing that I've been trying to do for so long. So that's when I called myself a poet in my own head, but saying it out loud to a person is a different kettle of fish. And I suppose that sort of fell into place once I did my master's in London, actually, because other people started calling me one, and I thought, oh shit, that might actually be true, you know.
It does sometimes. It takes other people to put the hat on us, you know, before we realize sometimes we're slow to accept what we really are or what we've evolved into. And I remember being in Amsterdam once, and I've been a very shy child. And when I was 25, 26, I still thought I was a shy child. And I went out with somebody for a drink, and I said to them, you know, I'm very shy. I've only been here a few weeks. I'm very shy. And she looked at me and said, what? You know, you're the most chatty, confident, you know, upbeat person that we've ever met. You know, everyone knows you. You've only been here a few weeks. But I hadn't realized, because for so long I'd been, no, Damien is a shy person. But someone else had to say, no, wake up. But yeah, it was an interesting realization.
That makes complete sense to me as well. In the poetic sense, it took other people to name me, you know.
Yeah.
For it to have any sort of meaning, which is not a great reflection of my sort of personal fortitude or anything, but at the same time, that's how it works a lot of the time.
And are you happy to claim it? Are you happy to be a poet? Is this what you thought was going to happen?
I suppose in some ways, this is the direction my life has been taking without me driving the car explicitly. I'm really happy to claim it.
talking about now No Man's Land, your debut full collection, which was published, as I said, by Daedalus Press in November 2023. I've only read almost half of it now. It's set predominantly in the landscape of your hometown, as you said yourself, but it does spread itself out, you know, through the rivers, through the birds, the soil, this extraordinary playfulness that you have with language, the mixing of Irish, of English, of myth, of mountain. Sometimes I felt almost to ease us into this steep sense of loss that is still planted within it. Even those moments of planting tree seeds in the soil, it almost seems to be asking too much of hope, too much of ecology itself. Perhaps you yourself can tell us a little bit more about the collection, how it came to be, what it was like pulling it together.
I found myself in the landscape that I had grown up in and that had shaped me in many ways about 3 or 4 years ago at this point. For the first time in a really long time, and because of...
And this is COVID, so you're locked down there.
Yeah. So because of that, I had nothing else to do except for walking. And the more I walked, the more I explored, curious I got about what I was walking inside,
mm-hmm.
which was nature, really. And then I started to think about nature, and am I part of it, or am I outside of it? And I began to get very curious about the names of things, because I didn't know if someone put a tree in front of me, I wouldn't have known what name it had. So I thought, okay, there's a little project. And I don't know if everyone has the same experience, but once you start down that road, it's very difficult to not see things and want to explore what they are and how they grow and things like that. That fed into curiosity about folklore and land knowledge and the sort of folkloric information that exists and still exists, actually, about landscape and flora and fauna and all of these things. Mm-hmm. And then I started to relearn Irish, which I had sort of left by the wayside a little once I had moved out of Ireland, and relearning Irish kind of put a different sort of color on all of these things that I was discovering. And by direct consequence of engaging with the natural world, it became a book about loss as well, as a mirror of my own feelings, because it's in a dangerous state. And what I would have looked at before as being an idyllic landscape, I now see as something that's not very healthy at all. And the book deals with that too.
And was that to a degree a part of, you know, childish innocence? You know, you see the pretty tree, you don't see what's affecting it. And you came back then as adults aware of, you know, ecology, climate.
There's an amount of naivety in mm-hmm. it, yeah. And there's an amount to which I think the propaganda had worked on me. Propaganda being the Tourism Ireland, like Fáilte yeah. Ireland stuff,
mm-hmm.
where what we're looking at as idyllic agricultural greenery is dead, really. That is land not fulfilling its potential in any sense. You know, a lot of people, including me, would have looked at that and thought how beautiful, how lush and full of life. And it's quite the opposite, you know.
Yeah. Was that a harsh reality?
Yes, it was. It was and continues to be, actually, because there's, I don't know, I'm quite a pessimist anyway. So it's difficult to convince me that there's much hope around the corner. And it was a relatively bleak personal time as well. But I have to say that it's been said to me that my work is sort of romantic and anti-romantic at the same time, in the sort of philosophical sense, you know, like yeah. there's always this nagging kind of kernel of hope won't go away in the depths, you know.
And there's a humor, you know, there are humorous touches in there, you know, there's enough to keep us afloat and to keep us almost wishing.
It's ridiculous and it's absurd, really, the situation we find ourselves in sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to laugh at it. Like, that might be the only response sometimes.
Yeah.
And humor is something that for a long time I would have balked at employing as a tool in poetry because I thought that that's not what poetry was. But humor's hard to pull off. It's something that I think is a little bit of a Trojan horse. It sort of smuggles the truth past someone whilst they're unawares, you know?
Like those plastic bags underneath the sinks that
Well,
made me laugh at the beginning, but it had such a twist that you think that you found your identity, this is what it means to be Irish, and then suddenly you start living in different countries and you say, oh, every bag stored under their sink.
I mean, that's a good example of it, I suppose, of the way that I like to employ humor, because it is a tool. It can mask a deeper, possibly darker truth.
One of the poems that you read earlier on this episode, the penultimate poem in the collection, was Queena. Can you maybe tell us a little bit more? Just maybe explain to the listeners a little bit more about this sort of mourning ritual, about this sense of keening, this not so little grief.
I knew at some point in the collection that I was going to write about those customs and those traditions, and I did a ton of research about keening and the tradition of it in the past, and like it didn't die out all that long ago, I suppose. And for the amount of research that I did to come out with a poem that's what, 11 lines long, like, it seems like I got a really bad return on my investment there. But I have a
No,
lot of
they
knowledge
are
about it
11 very beautiful, pessimistic lines. You know, the beauty to it.
now. Well, I mean, there's no such thing as bad education, really, either. I've learned an awful lot, and I'm a store of information now about keening. But in the process of learning about it, I thought that it's quite awful. I don't know, is it irony that the thing that I'm researching, which is a lamentation, is quite sad in itself, and the thing is dead now, and it would be interesting to treat the process of lamenting as a lament, you know? So there's a sense in that poem of a little bit of a letting go, like, oh, I really loved this. And this was a really important, useful, powerful custom. And I really wish we had held on to you, but we didn't. So sorry, but goodbye.
Well, it attaches up to the land itself. Is that an almost a, it's too late. We need to say goodbye.
Maybe not that pessimistic, but there is a reason why it's towards the end of the book, yeah.
In terms of the collection itself, in terms of pulling it together, in terms of its layout, it's really interesting. It's quite fresh in terms of how you did it. And there's also a certain amount of humor in it. You have one poem that's split across two pages, and you start reading the first few lines, and then you think, oh, hang on a minute, maybe I'm reading this wrong. And if you continue all the way down, you'll get to the end, and you'll be rewarded with the nonsense. And then you have another poem that's vertical. How important was it for you? And I know that you were also a visual artist. How important was it to have the visuals be as connected to the theme?
Quite important, actually, and I'm gratified that you noticed. Each poem was treating like it was treading very similar ground, literally as well as figuratively. So it was important to me that the way that they looked, first of all, on the page, the way that they interacted with the space of the page, and the way that they sort of presented themselves, the way that they fleshed themselves out, would appear differently as well. So in the sense that if there's I don't know how many poems are actually in the collection. If there's 50, then it's like different points of view of the same thing, sort of, you know. And they sort of took on their own lives, and once one was finished, I felt that that was that for that particular piece of work, and that I had to move on to something else, which is why I guess it took such a long time to write, because I was resetting myself poetically each time before moving on to another one, you know. The other thing about that, I wanted it to be surprising. The most important thing to me as a writer and as a reader as well is that I want poems to surprise me, and I want to be pulled out of expectation when I read stuff, which is a tall order as a reader. It's a big ask, and as much as a writer too, because that sets a very high ambition. So the layout of the book, I suppose, was a way of achieving that, if I achieved it.
I think you definitely achieved it. Huge congratulations on it. Before we go, just perhaps we'll talk about the front cover. How did the front cover come about?
I did a residency in the Berne College of Art in 2022, and it was the first time that a residency was given to a writer there, because it's a visual art college, really. So the people who are resident there, who are doing PhDs and masters, are involved in a really wide spectrum of art forms. And the people who come and do residencies also, and they interact very directly with the landscape and the materials that are available immediately. As it happened, there was a woman who was doing the residency at the same time as me, who was working a lot with fabric, making, dyeing her own fabric, and doing these really intricate and really beautiful embroidered paintings, I would kind of describe them as. Her name is Anna Galindo. She's from Canada, I think. And I saw some of her work in the kind of the open studios towards the end of our residency, and I just thought, I have to use this, because she had sort of encapsulated the way that rural Ireland looks, sort of wild, but at the same time very I don't know the word in English, sort of like squared off and fenced off at the same time.
And it's extraordinary because as I went through the collection, like it grows on you and its relevance becomes much more prevalent as you go through it. Like every now and then I'd read a poem and then I'd go back to the front cover and go, I can see why it's pulled me in. I think it's a beautiful companion to the collection itself.
I'm really happy with this, and I'm proud of the cover.
And sorry, what's the artist's name? Let's just mention her.
Anna Galindo.
Do you have any more readings? I know you're in Chile at the moment, but are you coming back for any more readings?
Yeah, I will be. I'll be coming back in April, and I imagine that I'll be in Ireland or the UK for the rest of the year then, doing readings in festivals and stuff like that. I'm still sort of filling up that calendar. Hopefully, I'll get to see and meet a lot more people, and you in person at some
Yes,
point.
exactly. Yes. I look forward to actually shaking your hand and congratulating you. David, thank you so much for joining us today on Eat the Storms. It's been a real pleasure. And congratulations again on No Man's Land.
Thank you very much, Hermoggets.
Now, just before I leave you today, there's enough time for me to share one poem, and the poem I've selected is in honour of David Nash, the first guest to join me on the Behind the Storms interview series, A Wonderful Guinea Pig. He was not harmed during the making of today's interview. David is from County Cork, and the poem I've picked appeared on a billboard in Fitzgerald's Park in County Cork last summer, thanks to Cork City Council, Cork City Libraries, and most importantly, the incredible Howl Journal, curated by the sensational duo that is Roisin Leggett-Bowen and Lauren O'Donovan. I've also selected this poem because its title is Bog Body, and in David's work, there are numerous mentions of bogs. So, David, thank you so much for joining me, and also thank you to all of my guests on today's show, Jane, Claire and Hiram. This is Bog Body from Howl 2023, and just to note, Howl 2024 is about to open for submissions, so keep your eyes peeled. Bog Body. Slumped over IKEA desk. Dusk delayed since time slipped back and morning darkened. Having just returned from garden, tying light ropes around hollow trees to serenade starlight, trying to avoid the knot of noose. I open a book to catch Fernando Pessoa bleeding over the book of Cesario Verde. I sing that same sorrow. Reduced to countryman, return to the mud of the country and the man so far from the cities where he burnt his skin on freedom. I write of other houses for fear I'll forget where I laid. Sketch shadows already disappearing from streets I once identified by scent. Where once I discovered what it was like to find your way out of being lost. One writes and no one reads till he dies. The other, leaning, reading, bleeding. We are only as devious as our smiles are wide. Feeling pressed between the beauty of a flower indoors and the snap of a stem from its root. Bound between page and peat, I walk these fields, bleeding for the smell of a city. Poetic peeps and gentle persons, in-betweeners and nonconformers, genders all and genders equal, we've reached the end of the first episode of Eat the Storms, a poetry podcast. My name is Damien B. Donnelly. I've been your host and producer, and thank you for tuning in today, whether that's been on Spotify, Apple, Google, Breaker, Podbean, Player FM, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Castbox, Podcast Addicts, or iTunes. My guests have been David Nash, Jane Clark, Claire Starling and Hiram LaRue. For details and all of my guests, you can head over to the website www.eatthestorms.com and click on the Listen to the Podcast section. There you will find a blog post for every episode, and in today's blog post, episode 1, season 8, you will find photos, bios and social media handles on how to find, follow and favour our wonderful guests. Now, please feel free to sing about, to shout about and to post about this podcast. We are an international community, and here at Eat the Storms, we realise that the spotlight can only truly give off warmth and light when it is shared by others. So please do me a favour and share the hell out of this bloody poetic storm. The music on today's podcast was from purpleplanet.com, and the podcast itself is produced on Spotify for Podcasters, formerly known as Anchor. Until the next time you tune your preferred podcast platform into your favourite storm, stay safe, stay bright, stay connected, and of course, as always, stay bloody poetic!
Oh, thank you.